Well, let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, page 668 in the Church Bible. I wonder if there's anyone here who doesn't want to be happy. I reckon most of us want to be happy. Well, chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes is all about Solomon's search for happiness. And if anyone should have found happiness, it should have been Solomon. Because Solomon was in the fortunate, or perhaps I should say unfortunate, position of being able to have anything he wanted. So he should have found happiness, shouldn't he? So what has Solomon got to tell us? And what has he got to tell young people in particular about happiness? Young people in particular, because actually Ecclesiastes is a young people's book. It's written for young people. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. It's advice to young people. So what has Solomon got to tell us about happiness, especially if we're young? Well, last week we saw that his studies had made him miserable. He hadn't been able to come up with any real answers. He decided to try and find the answers through research and study. And the result, verse 18 of chapter 1, the last verse of chapter 1, with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Because he found that there were certain things that his studies just couldn't change. Couldn't change the fact of death. Couldn't change the twist or the warp in human nature. Verse 15, chapter 1. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. There was a limitation to what learning and study and research could do. So in chapter 2, he decides, as people put it these days, to go out more. Or, again, as people put it these days, he decides to get a life. And off he goes in chapter 2 in pursuit of happiness. Verse 1, I thought in my heart, come now. Enough of all this study. Come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. So he goes to search for what will give him real, lasting happiness. Well, what about laughter? Verse 2. Laughter, I said. I mean, laughter is a sign of happiness, isn't it? When we're happy, we laugh. If we're laughing, we're happy. Maybe laughter is the secret of happiness. Well, genuine laughter can be a real sign of happiness. It can be a byproduct of real joy and real friendship and real fellowship. But it is a byproduct. And when laughter becomes the end in itself, when we seek laughter for its own sake, it becomes empty and it becomes foolish. Verse 2, laughter, I said, is foolish. Look at chapter 7, verse 6. Chapter 7, verse 6. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Don't you get fed up of the laughter on the television on a Saturday night? I do. Just the sheer noise, the sheer piped laughter all the time gets me down. Laughter can be cruel. And a great deal of laughter on the television these days is extremely cruel. There are more and more of these programs where they deliberately include people who can't sing, you know, in these X Factor type programs. They deliberately include people they know are going to make utter fools of themselves. And they're just there for us to laugh at. Like in the old days we used to go and watch the lunatics in Bedlam Hospital and laugh at the lunatic. Now we can do it on the television. Laughter can be cruel. Laughter can also be coarse. And a great deal of laughter on the television these days is what Paul calls in Ephesians coarse joking. And when we have to be fed with constant laughter, constant entertainment, constant comedy, it all becomes rather sad. It's always interested me that before the days of the variety show and the days of the television and so on, kings and queens who had absolutely everything that they wanted, who had multi-course meals every day, people like Henry VIII and so on, they had to employ a court jester whose sole purpose was to make them laugh, to keep their mind off everything and make them laugh. And isn't it true that comedians off stage are very often sad people? Just read the diaries of Kenneth Williams. Some of them are fueled, like Tommy Cooper, who I think was extremely funny, but was fueled by alcohol. And of course some of them, like Tony Hancock and Peter Sellers, it all ends in suicide. Comedians are often very sad. So, laughter isn't necessarily the way to happiness. So he tired of laughter, and he turned to other diversions. Verse 2, pleasure. And the word pleasure here is a wide term, and it covers good things as well as bad things. It covers all kinds of enjoyable diversions. Basically, he's saying he was out every night. His diary was full. Full of interesting, exciting, enjoyable events to look forward to. Social events, sporting events perhaps nowadays. He had a full diary. All kinds of things to divert him and amuse him and entertain him. And nowadays, of course, you don't have to go out, you just have to switch the telly on. And then there's the holidays to look forward to. And Christmas, of course, every year, which gets longer and longer every year. It starts earlier and earlier every year. And there's more and more hype every year. And so it goes on. Well, all this began to wear a bit thin. So he turned to wine. Verse 3, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. Isn't Ecclesiastes up to date? And millions of people in our society live for the weekend when they can just get drunk. I remember when I was in Stockport, we had a man do some decorating in our house. And he was a very nice man. And he did a good job of the decorating. And I got to know him quite well. And I said, what do you do at weekends? And he said, and he was perfectly serious. He said, I get drunk. And that was it. He lived for Friday night and Saturday night when he went out and got drunk. He went out with that aim in view of getting drunk every Friday night and every Saturday night. And then on Sunday, he stayed in bed all day and slept his off. Then he started his decorating again on Monday morning. He was a very nice man. But that was his life. Now, Solomon didn't go as far as that with the drink. He actually says, verse 3, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. He knew that there was no real fun in alcoholism. But wine for Solomon ceased to be one of God's good gifts, as it is, for instance, in chapter 9, verse 7. Chapter 9, verse 7. Go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for it is now that God favours what you do. Wine ceased to be for Solomon one of God's good gifts, one of God's many good gifts, and it became an end in itself. He perhaps didn't become an alcoholic, but he did become a connoisseur of fine wines. And of course, these days, you can try other drugs as well. And many people do, including many rich people who have just about everything they could possibly want. And they're still trying to find enjoyment through drugs. Well, in verse 4, he turns from this rather frivolous approach to happiness. And he begins to get down to business. He gets serious. Verse 4, I undertook great projects. He began to throw all his energy into work. Projects to show people how important he was. That was basically what he was trying to do. He was trying to show people how important he was by undertaking great projects. He didn't do all the dirty work himself. He had a huge force of slaves. Verse 7, I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. He didn't have to do the dirty work himself. He had plenty of people to work for him. And he began to really make a name for himself. He became one of those people who you find listed every year in the Sunday Times 100 richest people in Britain. And he was top of the list, or he would have been, if he'd been in Britain. Huge houses, multi-million dollar residences in central London, plus a country house and farm and estate, and a villa in the Mediterranean. Acres of land, gardens, parks, orchards, all watered with sophisticated irrigation systems, he says. He was surrounded by status symbols. I owned more flocks and herds than anyone in Jerusalem before me. Today he would have had a fleet of racehorses and a fleet of fast cars. And he became a patron of the arts. Musicians and singers. I acquired men and women singers. Verse 8. He could employ all the top artists, all the top musicians, all the top singers to perform for him. Again, music is another of God's great gifts, isn't it? Life would be much poorer and duller without music. But nowadays it's a drug. Nowadays it's constant. The disc jockey on the radio all day. The constant pipe music in the background, even when you're shopping. You just can't get away from it. And some people, especially young people, if it's switched off, they begin to get serious withdrawal symptoms. It's become another drug. And then, to top it all, if he was still bored, a spectacular harem. A harem as well. The delights of the heart of man. Actually, it was 300 wives and 700 concubines. And I can never remember whether that's the right way around. It might have been the other way around, but it doesn't matter. About 1,000 women to choose from. Any woman he fancied, any time. Well, sex in the Bible is one of God's great gifts as well. Just read the Song of Solomon. And incidentally, just in passing, I've decided that Solomon could not have been the author of Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. Because he says in Ecclesiastes, I searched and didn't find one good woman amongst 1,000. He said, I found one good man amongst a thousand. I didn't find one good woman amongst a thousand. Well, he had 1,000 wives and concubines. He didn't find one good one amongst them all, he said. So the man who wrote that could not have written Song of Solomon, which is all about the one good woman he'd found. I've never read that anywhere else in any other book, but I've proved to my own satisfaction that Solomon could not have been the author of both Song of Solomon and the book of Ecclesiastes. Sex is one of God's good gifts, a source of real enjoyment. But again, when it becomes the end in itself, it disappoints. It's meant to be part of a loving relationship. And it's very difficult to love 300 wives and 700 concubines. This was sex for its own sake. And sex for its own sake ends in emptiness and addiction. It doesn't end in joy. It ends in emptiness and addiction. If ever there was a man who should have found happiness, it was Solomon. He was, as somebody has described him, Bill Gates or Richard Branson and Hugh Hefner all rolled into one. He tried everything. Verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. He tried everything. Verse 12, second part of verse 12, what more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? He'd done it all. There was nothing else for his successor to do. He'd done it all. He tried it all. And the day came when he stopped, verse 11, and surveyed it all. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was Abel, vapor, vanity, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. That's the conclusion he came to when he stopped and surveyed all that he'd done. The problem is we rarely do that. We rarely stop and survey. We just keep going, don't we? We don't like to stop and think. That's the whole point of this constant escapism all around us, to stop us thinking, to stop us surveying. Solomon stopped and surveyed all that he had achieved and all that he had done, and he said, it's Abel. It's vapor. It's vanity. It's a chasing after the wind. It's like the child chasing that soap bubble, exhausting herself, and then as soon as she touches it, it bursts and she's left with nothing. And it's death that makes a nonsense of it all. He would leave it all behind and he would take nothing with him, and he would be forgotten, and all he'd achieved would be forgotten. In fact, he actually says, I'll probably have to leave it to somebody else who hasn't even worked for it. This is what gets him down. I'll have to leave it for somebody else who hasn't lifted a finger to work for it. He probably won't appreciate it, and he may even be a fool. Verse 19. Who knows? Verse 18. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is Abel. Verse 21, a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. Well, it's a reasonable point, isn't it? And in Solomon's case, of course, he was exactly right. His son was called Rehoboam, and he was a fool. And all that Solomon had achieved was frittered away by Rehoboam, and the kingdom he had built up was divided. There was a civil war because of Rehoboam's foolishness and stupidity, and the kingdom was divided, and the land of Israel never achieved again the sort of situation it achieved under Solomon. So he was exactly right. He left it to a fool. So it's Abel-Ezer. And if I turn over a new leaf and decide to get very serious, verse 12, I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. 13, I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, the fool walks in the darkness. So let's get serious, let's look into wisdom, let's look into morality. He says, if I do that, I'll still die. Verse 15, I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. So, if I decide to turn over a new leaf and get serious and become wise and become a righteous and moral person, then it doesn't get me anywhere. I'm still going to have to die, says Solomon. So what's the point? Death makes a nonsense of it all. In fact, if life is just the path to death, and that's it, life is nothing more than walking the plank. Remember the pirate story? Where the pirate used to walk the plank. He just used to walk along this plank. And that was it. He died at the end. And all right, some people might have longer planks than others. Or better planks than others. But if death is the end of it all, it's just a plank. And we're all walking it. And it all ends in death. So what did Solomon find? He found that if he looked to anything under the sun, as he puts it, as the ultimate source of happiness, it failed him and it disappointed him. So he says to us in the book of Ecclesiastes, and he says to young people in particular, don't do it. I've been there, I've tried it, I've got the t-shirt, it doesn't work. Take it from me. Don't do it. So what are we to conclude? What are we to conclude at the end of Solomon's pursuit of happiness under the sun? Well, let me give you a quotation from C.S. Lewis. He says, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. C.S. Lewis, the converted atheist, used to be an atheist, became a believer in God first of all, then he became a Christian. He says, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. There must be more to human happiness than life under the sun. We were made by God. We were made to know God and to enjoy Him forever, as the Westminster Shorter Catechism tells us, as we used to teach our children, and which I wish we still did. What is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. Augustine says in his Confessions, Thou hast made us for Thyself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in Thee. And So Ecclesiastes says in chapter 12 to young people, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Fear God. Which means put God in the right place in your life. Give Him the place He deserves in your life. Fear God and keep His commandments. There are other books, not Ecclesiastes, but there are other books in the Bible that tell us how we can come to know God. Ecclesiastes is the goad to drive us to the rest of the Bible. And it's a goad that the modern world really needs. In fact, I'm wondering whether we should start an Ecclesiastes series for non-Christians, you know, like the Christianity Explored. I don't know what we'd call it. Ecclesiastes Explored probably wouldn't go down that well. But I think the modern world needs to hear the message of Ecclesiastes. It's meant to be the goad to drive us to the rest of the Bible. And the rest of the Bible tells us how we can come to know God and to enjoy Him forever. The book of Genesis tells us how God made us for Himself, and how work under God in fellowship with God was satisfying. And then it tells us how we disobeyed God and rebelled against God, and the result of that was God's sentence of death upon the world. You are dust, and unto dust you will return. You will toil all the days of your life until you return to dust. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. God's sentence upon disobedient mankind. Abel. Vanity. And then there are other books in the Bible which tell us how God in His grace determined to turn this curse into a blessing and to restore us into a relationship with Himself through Jesus Christ, His Son. And Jesus Christ came into this world. He came into this world under the sun, and He died our death. He needn't have died, but He died our death, and He bore the judgment of God on the cross. And then He rose from the dead, jump-starting the new creation, which will be free from death and free from Abel, free from vanity. And Jesus Christ invites people who are hungry to come to Him and feed on the living bread. And He invites people who are thirsty to come to Him and drink. And He says, if you drink the water that I can give, you'll never thirst again. And He invites people who are weary and burdened to come to Him for rest. So I invite you to come to Jesus Christ this morning. He is the only one who will satisfy you. He is the only source of real and lasting joy. And what about the things that Solomon looked to for happiness? Do we reject them completely if we're Christians? Is the answer to hedonism, self-indulgence, miserable asceticism, the denial of all the pleasures that God has given to us richly to enjoy? Not at all. Not in the Bible. Not in Ecclesiastes. One of the themes of Ecclesiastes is that all God's good gifts are to be enjoyed in fellowship with Him and in gratitude to Him. If you make any one of His gifts ultimate, the main source of your happiness and satisfaction, it'll let you down. It'll let you down terribly. You will be disappointed. Idols will fail you. If you make any created thing the ultimate source of happiness, then because it wasn't designed to be the ultimate source of happiness, you'll need more and more of it to make you happy. You still won't be happy, so you'll need more and more. And so it will go on into emptiness and into addiction. That is what idols do. That is what drink does. That is what sex does. That is what laughter does. That is what entertainment does. But that is what work does as well. There are workaholics who can't stop working because working makes them feel so important. It makes them feel that their lives are significant. They can't stop doing it. And that's what money does. If it is made the ultimate, the source of joy, the source of happiness. Rockefeller, an American billionaire, was asked which of his millions he'd most enjoyed making. To which he replied, "The next one. The next one." Emptiness and addiction. When you make an idol, a created thing, the source of your happiness. It was never meant to be the source of your happiness. It was meant to be under God, one of God's bonuses to contribute to your happiness, but it was never meant to be the source of happiness. And if you make it the source of happiness, it'll let you down. You'll need more and more of it. It'll still let you down. You'll need still more of it. It'll still let you down. And you'll become an empty addict. And so making any thing under the sun your ultimate source of happiness will actually stop you enjoying it properly. You'll think you have to have a lot of it in order to enjoy it. And the message of Ecclesiastes is that you don't have to have a lot of it. Just enjoy what God has given you now. You don't need 300 wives and 700 concubines. Just one wife. Ecclesiastes says in chapter 9. And please, Ian, no remarks about mothers-in-law. Ian was heard to whisper when I made that remark recently about Solomon's 700 wives and 300 concubines. What about all those mothers-in-law? You don't need a lot to enjoy it. Just enjoy now with God what God has given you now. Don't imagine that there's something out there that if only you could possess or if you could only achieve it, you would be happy. No, no, you would be disappointed. Just be happy now with God and with what God has given you now. And Paul's comment on this in 1 Timothy is godliness with contentment is great gain. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Let's turn to our closing hymn.